You're listening to coverage from the 2008 Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show.
Okay, good morning, everybody. All right. Responses at 7:30 in the morning, that's upside. My name is Pierre Bertrand. I'm from Pfizer Animal Health. I want to welcome everybody. This is our 15th year of sponsoring Cattlemen's College, and I think we've got a great agenda for you. We've got some experts here today that will supplement some of the internal experts that some of you might have met from Pfizer Animal Health in the relationships that you've had in the field. Our veterinary operations folks have over 500 years of combined academic and private practice experience. And we're hoping to bring that expertise to you in all of the sessions that will be going on today. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Randy Block to kick off the Stair Steps to Profitability session. Thank you for your continued support in business, and look forward to the day and getting to meet some of you.
Good morning. Let's thank Pfizer Animal Health for making today possible. Well, we're excited to be with you today. I think we've got a great program. We've tried to leave plenty of time for interaction and questions throughout the course of the day, and we intend to do that. Obviously, we're in some dynamic times, some times that Pierre, even with 500 years of experience with your crew, and I look at several thousand years of collective experience with all the gray hair in this room, we're at times that probably are different for all of us. We've never seen some of the dynamics that we're dealing with today, and I think the title of today's program, Stair Steps of Profitability, is very appropriate for the decision-making that we have in front of us as we look down the road. Before we get started this morning, I would like to introduce our speakers that will be with us today. If you guys all just stand up, and Mike Murphy. Mike Murphy's been with CattleFacts for more than a decade. Mike heads up our risk management area with CattleFacts. Dr. Tom Field. Dr. Tom Field is on staff at Colorado State University, but we're fortunate to have Tom with our staff on a part-time basis to add some more expertise in the cow-calf and stocker areas for us around the country. Dwayne Lenz. Dwayne heads up our market analysis area, been with us about 20 years. Dwayne's got a tremendous amount of experience in the feedlot areas and also in the meat areas. Dwayne will be sharing part of the program today. Where is Todd? Is Todd in here? I don't see Todd in here. He slipped out. Mike Miller, are you back in here? Some of the other folks that slipped out, we'll make sure and get them introduced as the program goes on. Today, as we get started, what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time. The question that we've had asked, I can't tell you how many times we've had this question in the last 12 months. Do we still have a cattle cycle? Do we still have a cattle cycle? Most of us have built our businesses around that over a long period of time. We've had a great deal of predictability on the cattle cycle when we've looked at it historically. What I want to do is break the cycle into three phases. I want to talk about it from an inventory standpoint, a cattle cycle from a number standpoint. I want to talk about it from a production standpoint, and I want to talk about it from a price standpoint. Because I don't think a lot of times when people talk about cattle cycle, they really break it into those components. They roll all that together, and it ends up being mush. So let's break it apart and look at what we really have out here from an overall cattle inventory standpoint. If you go back And this is a little easier to see in what we have up here on the screen than it is in your book. But in each of these yellow dots that you see going all the way back into the 30s, each of those yellow dots represents 3 years past the cycle low in cow numbers. Look at the growth that we experienced here in the 30s. We had already seen significant growth in cow numbers. The same thing in the 40s, the same thing in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. That's where the old cattle cycle term came from. 3 years off your low in numbers, we'd already experienced some significant growth in inventory. Look what happened here in the early 1980s. Why was that one cut short? Corn prices was part of it. That was a little later on with the PIC program in 1984. How about 20-21% interest? Remember the runaway inflation we had in the late 70s, early 80s? 20-21% interest. We were losing money. It was a train wreck. We liquidated about 13 million head of cattle from the early 80s into the late 80s as we came through that phase of the cycle. Now, is there some similarities when you look at our environment that we're in today? Is there some similarities to what we saw in the second half of the 70s? I'm not going to go into a lot of detail in that, but I want you all to think about that. We'll come back to that a little bit later on, but I think that's something you need to be thinking about. We had low interest rates in the 70s. We had runaway inflation. We had stagflation as far as our economy, no economic growth, and yet runaway inflation. Is there a little bit of that going on today? We need to think those things through as we're making them and plotting our strategies down the road. Okay, here we are in the 80s. The 1990s, we started a little bit of a cycle. We came off there, but it really wasn't very robust, was it? We had a little bit of a cycle, and here you are in the decade today. No growth in numbers. I think it is safe to say that the cattle cycle that we've all grown up with is on life support. It is a very good possibility that the cattle cycle that we all experienced for years and years and years is gone. One of the things I want to take you back. 10-15 years ago, we were talking about the cattle cycle was going to change. We were going to see significant reductions as far as changes in inventory. We wouldn't see the big inventory fluctuations like what we've seen in the past, because we were going through a transition. Instead of being a commodity production unit where we were just building all this product and hoping somebody would buy it, to more of a pull-through economy. A pull-through economy where we would produce it, we'd see more alignments, we'd see more integration, coordination within our overall production system. And that is part of the reason I think we have what we have today. The cattle cycle, as we know it, with what we have going on, think about food policy, think about energy policy in our country today. Do those support a cattle cycle as we look down the road? No, they don't. Our present farm policy in this country and our energy policies, I think, collectively are going to keep us from growing this inventory for the next several years. We're not going to grow it very significantly within this country. I would be pretty comfortable saying that it isn't going to grow again in 2008. It'll be very similar to what we just saw here in 2007. The USDA put out their inventory numbers last week. We thought they were pretty much online, pretty much in line with what our estimates are. I would guess that that will continue. So, here's the inventory numbers. Now let's shift gears and let's look at the beef production cycle. You've got the same cattle inventory cycle in the blue up here. Now we got beef production laid over the top of it. Look at the cycle that we've had going on from a production standpoint. We're still getting some of that cycle movement. Beef production this last year was nearly record large. We've got 35 million fewer cattle than we had back in here total cattle than we had in the mid-70s. And look how much more production we're producing. Look how much bigger our production is off the herd we have today. Why? Are we in a technology cycle? Think about how much better we've gotten. Think about our animal health programs with Pfizer Animal Health and some of the other animal health programs with the products they've brought to market. Think about our nutrition programs. What's our market signal been? What's the strongest market signal that we have out there today? To add what? Weight. Have we responded to that signal? Absolutely. So we still have somewhat of a production cycle taking place in the industry. Now, our production isn't likely to increase much this year. It'll probably be up just slightly or flat. It's not going to change much, but we've still tended to have more of a production cycle than we have an inventory cycle over the last several years. And I think that's what we need to focus on. Because of our ability to produce so many more pounds out of each animal we have out here, think about how many more live calves we're weaning today than we were 20 years ago. I think the data would say out of every 100 cows we're weaning live calves, we're weaning as many as 4 more live calves out of every 100 cows. That's substantial. That's substantial, and that's part of the reason we're seeing these kind of productivity increases. If we look on, this isn't in your handout, but I wanted to reinforce this change in carcass weights. Back here in the mid-1970s, our carcass weights were 575 pounds. We're in excess of 775 pounds today. Over a 200-pound increase per animal. Well, if we're processing 33 or 34 million head of cattle a year and 28 million of them being fed cattle, That's where the production cycle comes from. Look for those things. Unless our economic signals change, and obviously $5 corn, $6 corn changes that economic signal, doesn't it? It changes that economic signal. When the cost of gain gets above the price of fed cattle, it really does have a significant impact. And hopefully that doesn't happen, but it's definitely a possibility. Now let's shift and let's look at the cattle price cycle. We've looked at inventory, we've looked at production, let's look at the price cycle. This is what we used to look at as the four phases of the price cycle. And I would say today that we still have somewhat of a price cycle working, but again, it's a little bit off kilter. If we look at it, we go through the up cycle, the transition, the down cycle, and again, the transition is as we start to move up. During these phases of the cycle, down here in the down part of the cycle, who's making most of the money? Who makes the money down there? Packers. Feeders start to make money right in here as we start to come out of it. The feed yards start to make money. We get into these transition years. Everybody gets profitable. The biggest profits are in the feeding segment of the industry, improved profitability in the stocker segment. Cow-calf guys cross over. Up here, who makes most of the money? Cow-calf. We've had 10 years of unprecedented profitability in the cow-calf industry, and we haven't expanded. 10 years. Our average profits in the cow-calf business from 1980 to 1999. Murph, I believe I'm correct in saying that was $2.04. $2.04 a head was our average profitability in that 20-year time period, 1980 to 1999. And we've made in excess of $100 a head over the last decade, on average. Some of you have done much better than that. But when we look at the average numbers, that'd be close to where we are. So we still have some of this taking place, and if you flip onto this graph, I think you can see it pretty well. This is the price piece of the cycle. We come in here, and this goes all the way back into the 70s as we look at the data. Obviously, you can see the run-up that we had in prices here in the 70s, then the break. This was the transition time period in the late 70s when we moved to a new and higher trading range. Prior to 2003, that was the last time that we moved the bar from a new and higher trading range. For all these years, from 1979 to 2003, we were captured basically in a $25 trading range, $58 cattle to $82 cattle. That was our range for 25 years. Then we made the transition, didn't we? We made the transition here very similar to what we did back in that time period here in this last 5-6 years. You can still see the cycle that takes place in here. The market's moving higher in here. The spreads tend to widen out. What tends to happen, though, when we have these high grain prices? We could put that here in 1984, too. What happens? Price spreads collapse, don't they? Is anybody in the room surprised today that calves are still bringing the value they are when we look at what cost of gains are? It's pretty amazing, isn't it? It's pretty amazing. Well, that's part of that bullishness that's in the back end of the board, the premium structure that we have all the way through this marketplace. So I think we still have somewhat of a price cycle in here. But if grain prices stay where they are for a long period of time, that too will tend to go away. That too will tend to go away because the market will have to seek out higher levels with smaller production levels with no inventory growth taking place. So the bottom line with cycle, there's really not much of an inventory cycle taking place. There's still a production cycle. The price cycle is probably going to change in here with these elevated grain prices that we've experienced. In the old days, it was pretty simple. The cycle lows in price came in the 5 and 6 year. The 5 and 6 year of a decade is where the low in prices occurred. The highs in prices occurred in what we called the 9-0-1 part of a decade. The 9 year, the 0 year, the 1 part. The 1 year. Well, we stretched that out a little bit in here in 1993 with the weather we had then. Obviously, we still had some of that into 2003 and 2004, a correction, but the markets obviously made another move to these higher levels with the lack of expansion that's taken place. What are the key factors that are driving it? Weather, obviously. Weather has continued to be a big problem. All we've done over the last several years, you've heard Dr. Art Douglas talk to you at these meetings for all of you that are Cattle Facts members. You read his stuff every month, and he's still not very bullish weather, is he? He's still not very bullish. This 50s drought pattern continues to plague various parts of the country. This last year, it was in the southeast and the west. Well, about 35% of the nation's cow herd was impacted by those two regions of the country. The year before that, it was the central and southern plains. Nearly half of our cows impacted with the weather in those areas. So weather has not been very friendly for us. Land values. Have you all seen some land appreciation? Absolutely. Land values have skyrocketed here in the last several years. They've gone up dramatically. They're probably not done. These land values will likely continue to move higher here over the next 12 to 24 months. Ethanol. Ethanol by itself is not totally responsible for what we're seeing with the grain markets. But it is having an impact. We are going to shift about 3 billion bushels of corn production to ethanol production. And when I talk about farm policy and we look at some of the things with the market really isn't having an opportunity to work, is it? We've got a 55-cent a gallon import tariff on ethanol product that could come in from Brazil. We've got a 51-cent a gallon blender credit on the other side. If the market could work, my guess is we wouldn't do all that we're going to do in building all of these ethanol plants around the country. It wouldn't get as big as what it's going to be. But we've all seen it before, and other times whenever we get government in here tweaking and playing a little bit, we end up with maybe a little bit bigger mess than, and it takes longer to get through it. It takes longer to get through it. But I think the combination of those things as it relates to this ethanol discussion are really quite serious when we look at what our world supplies are today. Alternative land uses. Is this, are you seeing it in your areas, whether it's hunting, oil and gas exploration, wind farms, depopulating ranches, whatever it may be, we're seeing those kind of things take place. We're obviously seeing a situation wherever we can grow crops with $10 wheat, $14 beans, $6 corn or $5 corn, the market is incentivizing us to run less cattle and try to crop as many acres as we can. So that's an area that will continue to be a challenge for the livestock industry here over the next several years. Urban sprawl. Tom, I've heard you use the number that year in and year out we lose about 9 million acres to urban sprawl across the U.S. Now, I don't know where you came up with that number, but it sounds good. So I'm going to repeat it. That's a big number when you think about it. 8 or 9 million acres lost to urban sprawl on an annual basis. And do you have anything you'd want to add to that?
Add, Randy, is that there are several economists who believe that in addition to that, in the next 10 years with the baby boomers literally ready to transfer their assets, that we will transfer assets in land equivalent to the size of the Louisiana Purchase to the next generation. And their choices are going to be very critical to what happens to this business.
Wow. That's significant. Policy, we've talked about government policy. Age of the producer. That's always been, I've been around quite a few years, and that's always been something we've talked about, but we don't have a lot of young people coming back in. And with the cost of entry today, when we look at land values, we look at what it costs to get in the business, credit availability, et cetera, that is obviously a challenge for us, and the profit and loss piece. This just gives you a pretty good feel of what's happened with these real estate values over time. This is average real estate values if we put them all together. It's about a 75% increase in values. But if we look at grazing values in the same time period of lands across the United States, they've increased over 100%. I believe the number is 102% is how much grazing land values have changed in here in that same five-year time period. There's the drought situation that we've had. Obviously, we've still got a mess down here in the southeast. The west has improved significantly this winter, but this drought mass, we need to stay focused on where that moves this year. We need to stay focused. Again, 25% of the nation's cow herd have been in the southeast region of the country. There's where our ethanol plants are. Are all these ethanol plants in the locations of where the cattle are being fed? The lion's share of these ethanol plants are up in here in the Midwest. We still have 75% of the nation's fed cattle fed from Nebraska, Colorado, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. 75% are fed in that five-state area. And we've got the lion's share of these ethanol plants further north or further east. So something's got freight on it, doesn't it? We've got a lot of wet feed. As this thing continues to build out, we're not likely going to be able to utilize all of that in livestock rations. And I doubt if we'll be able to use it all in pork rations or poultry rations, whatever the case may be. There's a change in grain prices. Again, we've had somewhat of a cycle in grain prices over a long period of time. This goes clear back into the early part of the 1900s. We spent 35 years from 1908 to 1942 with corn prices averaging 72 bushel. And you can see the variability we had around it. Then we moved up to a new range, spent 30 years from 1943 to 1972, or 43 to 72 at $1.27 a bushel. Then we raised it up again. You can see the transition we've been in. Over the last 18 months, we've shared with you, corn prices are going to move higher. Corn prices are going to move higher. This is a demand bull market in corn. It is not a supply bull market. Nearly every one of the markets that all of us have cut our teeth on over the course of the last 30 or 40 years have been supplies. We'll have a shortage of supply and a run-up in price, and it's short-lived. This is a demand bull. This will not be a short-lived situation with corn. Now, I'm not saying that corn is going to stay at $5 or $6, but corn is going to stay at elevated levels. We're very likely to stay up in here from 3 to 4. This year, we think we're going to get corn prices up in here $5.5 to $6 a bushel. We won't stay there, but we'll likely average on top of $4 for the year. But higher grain prices are going to be in place here for the next several years. Hay prices. I ran into a number of you last night. A little tougher winter than you anticipated. Have to go back in the market and buy hay. That's been quite a deal, hasn't it? Been quite a shock. Look at where these hay prices are. Well, if we have a choice, are we going to grow hay? Are we going to grow beans, wheat, whatever, when we look at the values there? We're not likely to fix this supply situation over on the hay side anytime soon either. So when you look at all of these cost elements, you put them all together. This isn't in your handout, but I thought it was very appropriate to share with you today, is just to take a real quick glimpse at how much some of these inputs have changed here over the course of the last several years. Hay's up 58%. Corn's up 94%. Pasture value's up 120%. Crude oil price is up 152%. Nitrogen's up 130%. And the value of a 750-pound steer is up 23%. Everybody get that? When you look at what's happened with inputs, you see what's changed with inputs, you put it all together with the current policy, I think it's very safe to say the cattle cycle that we've known from an inventory and number standpoint, until some of these things change, it's dead. It's dead. We can still see some production cycles as we move forward. We'll still see a lot of price volatility, but the cattle cycle itself is, as I said earlier, on life support. With that, I'm going to transition here, bring up Mike Murphy, and we'll move into some of the detail from an overall cost standpoint and some of the opportunities that we see relative to differentiating your overall production.
Thanks, Randy. Randy talked a lot about looking at some of the stuff from a cycle perspective and what we've seen more from a macro view. What we want to focus in on a little bit is talking about price, cost, and returns, and how those three kind of work together in terms of driving your business. When we look at this first graph, this is looking at our U.S. annual average calf price for a 550-pound steer. And you can see the cycle that Randy had talked about in here when you look at it from a price standpoint. I think as we go forward with some of the uncertainty that we have, we're not necessarily for sure what kind of a pattern we'll see in the next 5 to 10 years. If you'll see that cyclical nature or if it's more flat, there's a lot of variables out there that have to work themselves out, whether it's grain prices, the potential for higher fed cattle prices because of inflationary pushes. So we're not real sure, but the thing that we want to note here is that from a price standpoint, we know that when we start looking at costs, we have to be able to maintain these prices for this industry to be profitable. And if we're not profitable, then what's going to happen? We're going to continue to contract this industry more from an economic standpoint, let alone all the variables that Randy had talked about here in the last few minutes. So I think it's important to really understand where we need to be able to maintain these levels. And as we talk through a few more of these, you'll have a better handle of that. I think it's critical to understand where you are from a region standpoint and what that means from a price standpoint. We continue to see bigger and bigger discounts the farther away you are from the Central Plains, which is where the hub of the cattle feeding region is. When you think about the western region and the southeast region, this is looking at the data in terms of the western region. You can see that we've got bigger discounts in here when you go from where we were in the 1980s up to where we were in the early part of this decade and in this last year. Part of that goes back to the energy situation, transportation. You know, that's what we always kind of use as the simple basis was what was transportation from the western region or southeast into the Central Plains. There's other variables that are going on there as well that drives these spreads to be a little bit wider. So as a cow-calf producer, what you have to do is recognize, one, that we have bigger discounts in these regions. And then, two, what are certain things that you can do to try to capture more value for your calves? There might be several things. You might need to be looking at niche markets, whether those are trying to provide for a natural market. Maybe do some of the things that are related back to source and age verification where we've seen some pretty lofty premiums for those kind of cattle. It might be something that looks like we were trying to add more weight after you wean that calf. If you do that, obviously you need to be trying to manage your risk as you go through that process. But you've got to look at different ways to add value to that animal because you're essentially taking less in your part of the country, whether it's the west, the southeast, than you are in the Central Plains. So important to recognize that. Which kind of then ties in, we know what these prices are, you understand what we need to do in terms of adding that value, but really what are some other areas that you need to focus in terms of trying to help your returns? Well, obviously cost is that other part of the equation. This data looks at the CalFax data that we have run from a survey standpoint over the last couple of decades, and this may not fit anybody. It's more of an average, and what we really want to be able to illustrate here is that look at what we've seen in here over the course of the last few years. Significant increase in cost in terms of running a cow. This is cash cost, as you can see by the title of the graph. But look, just in the last 4 years, we've had almost a $60 increase in cost of running a cow. That has a direct impact on your returns. Where is this going to go when we start thinking about the graph that Randy showed right before I came up? What is the likelihood of cow cost starting to go back the other direction and decline? Not really good at this point in time, is it? Not here in the next 2 or 3 years. Costs are going to continue to rise as we look forward here in the short term. You've got to recognize that. This is something that we've been certainly talking about a lot in here over the last 5 to 7 years, where on average as an industry in the cow-calf sector, we've been profitable. And when you're profitable, those are times where you want to be able to start to try to look at different parts of your business to try to trim costs. Because if you happen to make a mistake, it's not going to be the end of the world. As your margins are shrinking, it becomes more difficult to experiment, if you will, in looking at ways of trimming costs. But the bottom line is we're in a scenario here where we have to do that. Costs are increasing. We recognize that. we've got to find ways to trim those costs. And we'll show you a little bit of data here in a few minutes that will help you understand how we can maybe do that. We got price, we got cost, and when we think about cost, the question that always comes up is that, well, you know, I'm in a region that I just can't trim costs. You know, it's impossible for me to trim costs. And that's not necessarily true the way we evaluate and look at the data historically. Again, this data comes from our survey, and you can see that when you look at the data, when we look at the region, there's very little variance across these regions. So it doesn't necessarily matter where you live, whether it's in Nevada, or if it's in Florida, or if it's in Montana. You have an opportunity to kind of have a manageable level, if you will, or target in terms of that cost number for running cows. You know, we like to use kind of that dollar a day. And I think we all recognize that that's not as achievable today as it was 3 or 4 years ago. But still, you've got to have a target, and I think somewhere in here that, you know, close to $400 a year on a cash cost standpoint is very achievable. And again, it doesn't matter where you are, you just got to be able to look at your operation, start to evaluate it, analyze it, and look for ways to trim those costs. And there's lots of help out there in terms of helping you make those decisions, whether it's extension help, whether it's looking at some of the pharmaceutical information that might be available, you know, things of looking at like having a nutritionist and a vet on consulting basis to help you make some of those decisions. All those little things will help you in the long run. It may cost a little money up front, but in the long run, it will help you trim down your cost structure. But what the bottom line is, we can talk about prices and we can talk about costs, but what we really want to do is get a return. And this is what we've seen in here. This is looking at our data, again, the cow-calf survey data, and we've got this data going back since the early 1980s. And the high-return producer, which is this yellow gold line, is the top third in our information or in our analysis with the survey data. The bottom third is this low-return producer. And then you can see here where we are from an average standpoint over time. But when you sit there and you look at it, as Randy pointed out a little earlier, the last 10 years have been pretty good for everybody. Obviously, everybody's had a little bit of an influence because of drought. In some of those years, it might have been a little thinner than others because of that. But the bottom line is on average, we've had a pretty good run in terms of profitability. Regardless of what your cost structure is, even the guys that we consider to be the low-return producers have made some money in here over the course of the last 10 years. Even with that being said, though, what's interesting, we're still losing some numbers in here, aren't we? We still have lost some beef cow numbers when you think about where we were back here in the late 90s. So that tells you that there's obviously some people that have even been worse off than what we're showing here in terms of the data. But when you look at this chart and you go home here after this meeting over the course of the next few days here in Reno, we always encourage people to go and just pull out your historical information from a return standpoint and just line yourself up and see where you measure against what the average is and what the high return and low return guys are. That's the first step, and then you can start to evaluate what is the best route to try to make more money within your operation, to improve your returns within your operation. But as you can see here, we think that the returns are going to decline in here over the course of the next couple of years. Obviously, we've had some decline the last few years. And why is it? It goes back to what we showed in that slide, declining calf prices, increasing costs. And so we're coming into a time frame where the returns are going to go ahead and decline in here the next few years. But there's always been certain things that when you look at and you measure the guys that are in the high return sector, there's certain things that they do in their business that stand out compared to everybody else that allows them to be a high-return operation. And it all kind of ties back in here. A lot of it ties back in here to see these below-average cow costs. Lower feed costs. On average, the high-return guys always have lower feed costs. And you ask yourself, well, how does that work? Well, a lot of it goes back to some of the other things that we have here. They probably have a little bit more efficient cow. Maybe a cow that's in their region can eat less and still be an efficient kind of a cow. At times, they might have been the producers out there that when hay prices were low, that they were stockpiling a lot of hay for the next few years, just taking advantage of the market when they have that opportunity. might be operations where instead of raising all of their own feed, they're actually buying feed out there in the open market. Think about what we see in terms of just the equipment cost of trying to produce hay. Does it make more sense to go out there and buy your feed on an annual basis versus raising it? You know, in some of those regions, and that's not going to apply as much here in the western region, but when we get in the southeast, where we run a lot of these operations on 200- and 300-acre deals, these smaller operations, why don't we share some equipment? Why do we all need to have our own tractor and our own mower and our own baler? We can share some equipment. These are different things. Looking at the alternative feed products that might be out there, especially here in the last few years, if you happen to be in the Central Plains in the Midwest, some of the byproduct from ethanol might have been opportunities for these guys to have a lower feed cost base. Interest. You know, in general, they have lower interest expense because they have less debt against their operation or against their cows. When they've made a little bit of money, they've been able to pay down their note a little more so they don't have to carry as much interest cost. That's been a very strong one for the guys in terms of these high-return producers. Lower general operating expense. And then you get into some more of the production stuff. Higher average weaning weights. Higher conception rates. More pounds weaned per cow exposed. That goes back to having data. The key thing for any cow-calf operation is data. That's the key thing for any business. But if you've got the data, and then you can use that data to measure yourself, benchmark what you've done historically, you're going to be able to evaluate where the opportunities are. Granted, all cow-calf operations are not going to be able to step out there and say, yeah, well, we can do this, and we can do this, and we can do this within the next year or two. As you guys know, it doesn't work that quickly in the cow-calf business. But there's still opportunity, I think, for all operations to take advantage of this. There's times when you have, like we've seen here in the last couple of years, especially in the southeast and a year ago in the south central plains, where you had to feed a little bit more through the summertime, so your feed cost was going to go up a little bit more, but you were able to get a higher conception rate, and you had to do that because you had to have the conditions for your cows. It's moving with what's being dealt with you throughout the year and recognizing and making the changes that you need to and acting quickly when you make those changes. Here's one that I think is always interesting. High-quality bulls with strong genetics. When we go back and look at our data in the last 20 years in our survey, the high-return producers spend the most money on bulls every single year. They go out there, they select the right kind of genetics, they're studying the genetics, they're watching the EPDs. Obviously, they need to be able to have bulls, especially in the big country out here in the West, that can adapt to their region and travel. There's no doubt about that. But they spend the most money, those high-return producers spend more money on genetics. That's very critical. We got to continue to evaluate our business and recognize what we need there in terms of that better genetic. Another point. The high-return producers always spend the most money on their herd health programs. That's where they have a vet on consultant or a nutrition on consultant. Asking the questions, looking at their business, seeing where they need to make sure that they're vaccinating their cows and doing all those types of things, worming all those types of things. So they get the most efficiencies out of those cows. And ultimately getting the most efficiencies out of those cows with the least amount of feed and getting a calf on the ground. That's critical. So utilize the different opportunities out there that you can see in terms of education. You know, that's a big thing that I think you'll also find in terms of the high-return producers is that they're always willing to go out there and try to learn more about what are some new technologies coming out in the industry, whether it's coming from companies like Pfizer or whoever it might be, but they're always out there trying to get educated, just like you guys are today with the whole Cattlemen's College, trying to capture more information to be able to make a better decision. And then the last thing here, which kind of ties back to everything, is that high-quality pastures. The one thing that the high-return producer does is he never overgrazes his operation. If it's a kind of a year where things are a little bit thin, what you always find those guys doing is that they step out and they'll feed those cows a little bit more and they won't ever overgraze their pastures. Because as you guys know, as stewards of the land, if you happen to go too far in terms of overgrazing, it takes that much longer to get that pasture back into condition. And that's very critical. So these are all habits of the high return producers. Again, I want to stress the point that you can't go out there and try to make all these happen in a 1 or 2 year period. But you can sit down and evaluate your operation and see where there might be opportunities to try to apply some of these types of returns. And as we see margins shrinking, and it's concerning when you think about what Randy was talking about, where you've seen in those other high grain price times when, within the cycle, the way that the feeder feds have really collapsed, if you will, whether it's a fed cattle market to the calf market. If we're starting to see cattle here, fed cattle in the $1.05, $1.10 area, and we're going to continue to see those high grain prices and we see those spreads collapse, you know, that's worth another $10 down in terms of your calf market from where we were in 2007, where we averaged about 119. That's 50, 60 bucks a head. It's a big deal here. So, again, we need to really focus in on trying to improve your returns for your operation. This is what I was talking about with those spreads. Here's where we were back in this time frame, some of the higher corn prices. Here we were in the mid-90s. And you can see this is through 2007, but part of that is corn here, the way that we really narrowed up that spread between a calf and a fed cattle market. Now, on the flip side, though, as I talked a little bit earlier, in terms of trying to add value to your operation, when we go back and evaluate this data historically, one of the best times to retain ownership is when you see those spreads narrow up significantly. Mid-90s is a good example of that. One of the best times to sit there and try to retain ownership. This is 2001 coming into 2002. Another great time to retain ownership that really worked well for the cow-calf operation. So be thinking about that when you look at your business. 2008, when we think about the fall calf crop, or the spring calf crop that we're going to wean this fall, this might be a year where it's an opportunity that you're going to want to retain ownership. Something we'll have to evaluate. You know, we say managing the cattle cycle in down market years, and as Randy went through when he looked at it from an inventory standpoint, a production standpoint, and a price standpoint. And really what we want to focus in here is more from the price side. Recognize price seasonality will be very volatile. The one thing that we need to realize in this business is that the higher the market goes, the wider the ranges are going to be. As Randy was discussing, the market from 60 to 80, okay, and you're talking about, you know, a 20-25% range in the market. Well, think about a 20-25% range in the market when you start from 80 to where we're going to go. Wider ranges, and that's going to apply at the fed cattle, and then those ranges widen as you go into the feeder cattle and cow-calf sector. And we've seen that. Another thing to recognize here when you think about the volatility or the price spreads is that the price spreads within calf prices and calf values. Today, at any given sale barn in the country, for a 4 to 5 weight animal, you'll have a $20 100-weight spread in the animals. We start to see the separation in terms of perceived or real value for those calves. We're seeing it every day. These spreads are getting wider and wider and wider for these cattle as we start to market them. Part of that goes back to other variables. If we're looking at maybe some of the niche markets, the naturals, or you know, weaned kind of calves, whatever the case is. But anytime you can see a $20 hundredweight, and in some regions, it'll even be wider than that. So we've got to recognize that. Focus on optimizing cost and production. Again, we continue to want to stress the point that we've got to be able to manage our cost. As I mentioned, adding weight may pay dividends. The only thing that I would say is that if you want to go ahead and try to implement that into your business, is that you're going to want to maybe take the next step and evaluate whether or not you need to be managing your risk in terms of adding that weight. You think about this last 5 month period. If you would have held your calves from the fall here in October, November, and held them and add some weight, grew those calves into here the January time frame. If you didn't take a position and try to protect yourself on the futures market, the feeder cattle futures market, you didn't make as much money. Because what did the market do? That feeder, January feeder futures were at 113, 112 there in that October-November time frame, and they went straight to a dollar. And yeah, you added weight, but that market went, the cash market went down as well. So understand that adding weight may pay dividends, but adding weight also means that you're probably having to add the length or ownership of that animal, extending the ownership length of that animal. So we need to think about trying to manage the risk against that. Very, very important to understand that. Analyze forward selling opportunities. Obviously, we see this a lot out in the Western region. You know, the videos, when we go back and evaluate the last 10 years of data, I think there's only been two where those summer videos didn't sell higher than where you would have sold those calves in the fall time frame. It's a heck of an opportunity. Doesn't mean you have to sell all of your calves on the video. Again, we can diversify ourselves a little bit. Maybe you sell just the steer calves on the video and you sell the heifers during the fall run. Whatever the case is, that's part of you looking at your business plan and evaluating. But those are opportunities that we have to be thinking about in our business. And again, risk management options, especially if you're retaining ownership on any of the cattle. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk more about the stocker operation and what we see here in the next several years from that sector of the industry. We call it the inventory shock absorber. Really what we mean is, in terms of our stocker business, is that you got the guy that's selling the calves and you got the guy that wants to feed them out. And somewhere in between, we call it a stock operator, but it's a grower, backgrounder, whatever you want to term it. You're just trying to add weight as efficiently and as cheaply as you can. And as we know, what is the cheapest way to add weight today in our industry? Grass, right? We're sitting here dealing with total cost of gains, or feed yard cost of gains, somewhere here in the 80-cent range, and we're still able to kind of sell grass, if you will, somewhere in the mid to upper 30s. So grass is that opportunity. What you're going to find more and more of across the region is that if the grass is available, if we're going to continue to have these higher grain prices, we're going to have more and more cattle being turned out into grass operations where it's achievable because of Mother Nature, if she allows it. But it's important. The stock operator is in a unique scenario. Another part of that is that he may not have to have ownership on the cattle. Stocker, grower, backgrounders, there's going to be a spot in here over the next few years where you don't necessarily have to have ownership of the cattle. You'll be more of that quote-unquote contract grower, if you will, or contract back to the feedlots. Or you might share in some of the risk. You might own a portion of the cattle, the feed yards own a portion of the cattle, whatever the case is. In declining supplies like we've laid out in here, the stock operator with higher cost of gains is in a very unique situation because he's the one that kind of can drive how he wants to model his business. So he's got a very good opportunity here to say, I don't want to have to take on all the risk. And the feed yard guys, well, he's going to want to be able to capture and make sure he's got a supply of cattle coming into that excess feeding capacity. This is where he's going to have to step back to the stocker guy and say, okay, I just want you to run these cattle, or let's partner on these cattle, or whatever the case might be. So you're in a very unique situation here. Warehousing cattle is what we're talking about there. Add value and improve quality. Obviously, all the cattle out there are not of great quality. That's what a grower stocker guy can do. He can take more of a high-risk calf, straighten that calf out, and you're adding value to that animal for the feed yard. Now, there's a cost of doing that, obviously, and you've got to get paid for it, but there's certainly some opportunity there to generate a positive return. When we think about it from a price standpoint, you can just see what, you know, it goes back to what Randy was talking about. You can see how we were in the 80s and into the first part of this decade where we just had a kind of a 50 to 90 cent trading range on feeder cattle values. Looks like we're kind of establishing a different range in here, closer from kind of $1.95 to $1 up towards $1.15, $1.20. And most likely that's going to be where the range is in here over the course of the next couple of years. Seasonality, this goes back to terms of trying to marketing of the cattle. We always want to be able to understand what is the seasonal of the market, and we need to have reasons as to why we want to fade the seasonal. This goes back again to trying to figure out when you want to sell your animals if you happen to be in that business. You know, again, 8 out of 10 years, here's where the highs of the market are in terms of feeder cattle. So, if you're sitting there and you're turning your cattle out on grass in the May, early June time frame, and somebody's coming to you and they want to buy your feeder cattle, and they want to buy them at current prices, probably not necessarily such a good idea. Probably want to be patient and wait for the market to improve as we go into the summer time frame, because that's what the strong seasonal is. You know, we're always monitoring if there's something, some reason why we like want to ignore what the seasonal is telling us. And at this point in time, when we think about it, you know, drought is one of those major influencers, and then grain prices can certainly have some impact as well. And then the final one would be profitability at the feedlot level. Those are all reasons why you'd want to ignore the seasonality. Again, looking at some of the spreads, the basis, if you will, between the Central Plains and the West, you can see here what we've seen in 2007, a big spread when you look at these cattle. So it goes back, and the same things apply back to the feeder cattle as it did to the cow-calf. Got to find ways to try to recognize what that spread is and then see if we can't find ways to capture if there's an opportunity to be able to feed those cattle. Or that might be one of those opportunities to feed these cattle. You know, we might want to retain ownership on these cattle, feed them maybe somewhere in the west or the northwest if you're in this region. And most of these prices are kind of based off the Central Plains region. So there's a way to be able to capture some of the margin in your business here as a stocker operator. This is looking at it from the southeast. Obviously got a little bit more of a discount when you look at it. And part of that was going back to just what we've seen in here with some of the drought concerns there in 2007. Looking at profitability, and we've got a couple of graphs here. This is winter grazing programs, and this is going to apply for the wheat pasture region, apply for kind of the California winter grazing. This is a pretty good program historically. But the challenge with this program is that you don't always have winter grazing. This is a good example this year. We've turned less cattle out on winter grazing this year than we have in like 5 or 6 years in terms of that winter wheat pasture in that Southern Plains. So you don't always have the ability to turn cattle out. Now, if we went back and looked at some of this data in terms of a growing operation through the winter, it's still a pretty good program as well. We think about it from a summer standpoint, though, everybody, for the most part, has an opportunity to try to run some summer grass cattle. And as you can see, looking at the returns, on average, it's a pretty good return on your business from 1980 to 2002. The only thing I really want to point out here is that these record profitability that we've seen in here the last 5 years, I don't think you can expect to see that kind of profitability continue in the next few years. We continue to drain equity out of the feeding sector, the cattle feeding sector. In the last 10 years, since 1998, the cattle feeding sector has made about $5 per head. Once we get them back to a break even, where they've lost all that equity that we've gained in here in that 2002, 3, 4 time frame, which most likely we'll do that here over the course of the next couple of years, but once all that equity is drained out, what they're going to do is they're going to take it right back out on the next guy in line, which is the feeder cattle. And they'll start buying feeder cattle that are making sense when they purchase them the day they buy them that will work against the back end of the board. And what that means is that most likely you guys will have all of a sudden, boom, collapse, and your margins will be whatever they are, like here with your $100 bill, boom, they collapse, and they're only closer to 20-25, maybe closer to that historical average. You've seen that in some of these years, like in 1998, 2002, you go back here in the early 80s, 1994, those are all years where when we really, really bled a lot of red ink in the cattle feeding sector. That's what happens is it comes back and it'll bite the stocker operator next. This last graph up here is just looking at it from what kind of an impact does corn have on feeder cattle values? And what we've done here is we've got what we call the fed cattle price here on the left axis. You've got the corn price per bushel on your top axis, and then these are the feeder values in the middle. And what you can see here is if you take corn, if we're talking about an average fed market of 94 cents, and you've got corn at 350 a bushel, and then all of a sudden it starts averaging 450 a bushel, you know, it's $11, $12, $13 impact on feeder cattle values. That's how much impact corn has. That's why it's so much more concerning with these higher grain prices. But it's also more difficult when you think about trying to know for certain within a more narrow range of where we're going to see feeder cattle values as we look out here in the next year or two, because we could potentially see 50, 75 cent dollar changes in corn prices on an annual basis the next two or three or four years. So just understand but what kind of an impact this has on your business. With that, I'm going to go ahead and turn over to Tom Field, and he's going to take you through the next few slides.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, everybody. You guys are better than college students. You're all here early in the morning, and everybody looks like they're not at all hungover yet. So you guys can pity me. I'm in charge of 10 college students in Reno for 4 days. So if I start looking gray, it's because they're having more fun than I am. I want to share with you just real quickly a few thoughts about a study that we did, sponsored by the American Angus Association, that was really driven by the concept that these are pretty complex times. I've got to tell you, I sat here this morning, every time I listened to Randy and Mike and Dwayne and the whole group, I think this is a complex business, and I'm reminded of Tom Peters, probably one of the top three or four management consultants in the general business community in the world, who a couple years ago I heard him say, you know, the average farmer and rancher in the United States makes more decisions in a day than the average CEO of a Fortune 500 company does in a month. This is a complex business. We should never apologize for how complex our lives are, and no one should ever say you're just a farmer, because we live in very, very complex, changing times. And the reality is, guys like me keep cranking the information out, throwing the data at you. And at a meeting not too long ago, one of my friends leaned over and he says, just start counting the number of what we should do's happens here today. And we started counting. And then he handed me a Drover's and a Beef and two or three other publications. He says, count the number of to do's. And by the time we got done, y'all's list was really long of what you should do. And so what we wanted to do was try to understand what do really successful cow-calf producers and their advisors, how do they sort through all of that? Where do they put their priorities and where do they focus their energies to stay successful in this complex business? The reality is that biological and financial data and information are not perfectly integrated, and yet in your world, financial and biological factors are not standalone ventures. They come together all the time. The reality is that when we started the war on fat years ago, which was really the first step of this industry becoming consumer-driven, we set off a chain of events that created this supply chain focus, which changed the business, changed it forever. The reality is that the things that happen external to your business, those things have not gotten less chaotic. I mean, think about yesterday, Super Tuesday, an amazing discussion and process of determining the political future of this country, coupled with severe storms in the southeast, and our hearts go out to all of our friends and neighbors in that part of the country who were devastated by those storms yesterday. The fact of the matter is the things swirling around us are as complex as the things that we do day-to-day inside of our own businesses. The volume of information does not go away. And the problem is we don't really yet have these really cohesive benchmarking systems that allow us to measure our progress in clear ways. So how do we deal with all that complexity? At the end of the day, it's goal-driven. It's remembering to stay focused in the midst of chaos. It's remembering to know where to place your energy and your time and your resources by measuring critical elements, by benchmarking those results, and by evaluating and realigning your resources, your time, and your energy. And our question when we started this study was, is what percentage of the industry does that? And can we help create a roadmap for people that at least in general terms lets them know where the most successful people in this industry focus their time and energy? Great performance happens from the bottom up in the cow-calf business. There are fundamental things that must be accomplished to just allow us to survive day to day. We begin to create this stair step to value. Those folks who are profitable beyond industry average, when they can find ways to add some value and some valuable management to those basic elements, and the folks who really thrive in this business reach up into that pinnacle of what we call best performance. But it starts from the bottom up. We asked a whole number of people. Our survey request was to about 250 folks. We got 217 responses, 130 producers, and 87 specialists, those folks who from the financial, technical, pharmacological, veterinary, nutritional, consulting areas interact with cow-calf producers. Our cow-calf producer demographics were about 22% owners or part owners, 62% who had a position as owners and managers, and 16% who managed enterprises but did not have an ownership role. Equal distribution of herds less than 200 cows, 200 to 499 on up to more than 1,000 cows. We targeted this survey to larger producers. 13% of our respondents were less than 40 years of age, two-thirds of them 40 to 59 years of age, and about 20% 60 years or older. So we felt we got a pretty good demographic in the industry. From a numbers standpoint, about 23% of our producers out of the Midwest, 10% from the Northwest, 28% from the Southeast, 30% from the South Plains, and 9% from the Southwest, relatively close to the cow distribution that you saw earlier from Randy. We did ask people about their marketing, and this is something that we found interesting and I think that is worth noting from the study. The average producer respondent sold about a third of their calves at wean, about a third as yearlings, and about a third as fed cattle. In other words, they were spreading risk and looking for opportunities to add value to the right cattle at the right times in the right markets. They weren't an all-in, all-out deal. It wasn't all the eggs in one basket kind of an approach. About a third sold 50% or more of their calves at weaning. About a third sold 50% or more of their calves as yearlings, and about 42%, interesting to us, sold 50% or more of their calves as fed cattle. What that told us was is that the cow-calf producers that we surveyed who were being successful, who we interpreted as highly profitable enterprises, were in fact participating in the supply chain, and they were trying to capture the value in their cattle down the line. Now, you've heard a lot of information this morning that suggests there's going to be some pressure backwards against our desire maybe to participate in that value capture given the price of corn and the risk of owning cattle further into the supply chain. The thing I would suggest to all of us, though, is that as we look at this next couple of years of high volatility and some uncertainty, that we not give up our commitment to value and quality in this industry that built consumer demand, that has set us up for the future to be profitable so that we can pass on our assets and our land to our children. We must not falter in that approach to provide the best product in the world to consumers. And so the marketing focus is going to be incredibly important for us. We literally ask people to prioritize into kind of three basic buckets: high priority, medium priority, and low priority. In other words, the high priority items, we have to do this. For us to stay in business, we got to get this done. And then there was kind of the, boy, it's sure great if we can get to this kind of category. And then it was the, man, if there's any time left or any money left or mom will let loose of any of the checkbook, we try to get these things done. So it's kind of high, medium, and low. And when we put all of it together, the specialist responses, the cow-calf producer responses, combined those, we kind of got our magnificent seven, which was led with herd nutrition, nearly scored a nine. That was the highest priority from this survey. That was not surprising to us at all, and right behind it, Pasture and Range, which told us that producers and their advisors were trying to figure out ways to move out of expensive purchased feed inputs from a mainstream approach, move to Pasture and Range, and then use those purchased inputs as critical, precision-driven, supportive elements as opposed to mainstream elements of the ration. We think, when we think about what you saw in terms of the increase in land value, clearly the cow-calf business in this country is going to be pushed to more marginal acres, and we're going to have to do more and more on traditional pasture and range settings. Herd health came in a very close third, and really, when you look at these top seven, I don't know that it really matters which one is one. These are the things that people are focusing on. Herd health sits right behind it. Financial management and marketing hand-in-hand right behind that. Production management with a large focus on reproductive management right behind that. And then genetics. Interestingly enough, labor sat in at eighth in this region of the country. On up into the Northwest, though, we saw labor jump two or three spots as labor availability clearly is a higher concern for producers in the Northwest than any other region of the country. We thought that was an interesting result as well. Now, very clearly, when we combined across all regions, producers and the specialists did not align perfectly, but they were relatively close throughout these. I just want to show this to you to let you know there was some difference, and there were some regional differences that we can talk about after this is over. You can get a copy of this full report either off the website for the American Angus Association. Just Google for priorities first and you'll find that, or you can certainly email us and we'll get that to you. But folks spent less energy down here worrying about harvested forage and supplemental feed. They were beginning to deprioritize this. Some of the things like biosecurity and quality assurance were not considered unimportant. They were simply things that got less of the time and energy from producers who made sure that nutrition, pasture management, herd health, financial management, marketing, et cetera, were taken care of first. And it gives us some idea about the way that producers prioritize their time and their energy. I want to finish with just a quick look at the marketing subcategories that we observed from this survey. Marketing the calf crop was the highest priority item. That was where people focused their highest degree of energy. But right behind it was choosing the appropriate market channel and choosing the right channel for the right cattle. And we interpret that as the steer mates to the replacement heifers likely went one way, the terminal cross cattle went another, and that there was a very high degree of energy put into selecting the right cattle to go into the right channels. Marketing cull cows, relatively high, and Gary Smith, that'll make you happy to know that the national non-fed audits resonate with people because they recognize the profit opportunity of managing and marketing cull cows and cull bulls appropriately, and then also those replacement females as people mitigate their herd inventory relative to pasture conditions and profit opportunities. The reality is this, is that you're going to hear a lot in the next few days about what you should do. This is a complex time. It's a chaotic time, but it's also a time that will resonate with opportunity for those producers who keep their priorities first and who have the courage and the vision to manage with precision and to seek those opportunities even in changing times. I want to turn it back over now to Duane, who will take you through some more information about structural changes in our business. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tom. How's everybody doing? I guess I would argue a little bit with Tom about not having anybody hung over in the room. I would venture to guess we probably got at least one or two that probably had a pretty good time last night. And of course, that's what we're here in Reno to do. I'm going to take the program and start to wind down towards the end. We're going to start talking about some of the changes going on in the beef industry. what that's going to mean for some opportunity out there for everybody, and some of the things that you can do to help manage in this challenging and in this changing time. And there are some things that can be done. If we just take a look and start where the feed yards, the big feed yards is, and this is feed yards over 16,000 head. You can draw a box there going from Nebraska down into Colorado, Kansas, and then down into about the Lubbock, Texas area of the Panhandle. As Randy mentioned earlier, about 75% of all the cattle are fed in that box. The other half have to, the other 25% are scattered out, some in the west, some in the Iowa, Illinois region. Now, is this box changing? Is it doing something different? The big talk with all the ethanol going on, we're going to shift all this feeding into the north. Well, there's probably some validity to that. We are probably going to ship some of it north into Nebraska. Can we shift it east into Iowa, though? That's probably going to be a real big challenge, just given some of the environmental concerns that we have in the Midwest. We can take some of those cattle from the bottom end of the Panhandle and change those into, especially the central and western Nebraska. In fact, we've seen some of that happen over the last year or two. But there's probably not going to be a big shift in this feeding area and what we do as far as feeding cattle in an area. So that leaves, there's about 50% of the cow herd in that area. That leaves the 25% in the southeast, the 10% in the west. Everybody's got to funnel into that. You can lay the major packers over that same area and find the best where most of the packers are located as well. The industry is kind of going to that. We've got to figure out a way. Mike Murphy spent some time talking about the costs that are involved and have grown in getting cattle into that area. That's something we have to manage around. Anytime you can leave cattle in the same region to feed and to be processed, that saves costs for the industry. But that's been very, very difficult to do in these changing times and the higher fuel costs especially. So we're probably going to have to continue to look there. If you look at these 16,000 head yards or bigger, there's about 72% of all the cattle that are fed in feed yards of that size. If you really look at the decision makers of the 16,000 yards, that represents about 250 yards. And, of course, some of those are multiple ownership yards. One yard might have 3, 4, 5 yards. So looking at the decision makers, and what's going on is constantly changing. If you go back in time, there used to be feed yards scattered through the Midwest, more feed yards in the West, but that's changing. The marketplace is shifting. We're going to talk about what happened in the Western U.S. quite a bit here in a minute. I went back and I looked at what happened. I thought, boy, those guys, they lost a lot of markets. But they didn't lose their markets. Their markets shifted on them. That's what we see every day in the industry is how the marketplace are shifting and how do we manage that? How do we control that? Because usually when markets shift, it adds cost to us. And that's something we're going to focus on. Beef cow operations, you can see how the number of beef cow operations have dropped over time. It's a substantial drop going back from 1980 to the current time, 1.2 million to where we sit just under 800,000 right now. Randy outlined a lot of the reasons why. It's an older population. There's things we can do with this land. We can go in the southeast, put the trees on that land. In the south, you can lease it out for hunting. In the northwest and west, we have people coming in to buy land to do other things rather than running cows on it. It may or may not be profitable. A lot of those folks don't care, but it still changes. The other thing that we see is, especially when folks get older, they want to retire, they want to do something different. Obviously, the kids, my generation and younger, have other careers and really not interested in moving back and taking over that operation. So it ends up getting sold to a neighbor. Neighbors like that. Neighbors know who their neighbors are then. So they're more willing all the time to absorb that piece of land next door and grow that operation. Is this trend done? Have we seen this trend come to a bottom? I guess I would argue not. I think we're going to see that trend continue over time. When neighbors take on neighbors' land and add to that, though, we start seeing more cows in less hands. And this is a graph that illustrates that really well. It's percent of U.S. cows and herd with more than 100 cows, that's a big increase. Gone from less than half to more than half. Again, we'd argue that this is probably going to be a trend that continues over time. We're going to see fewer cows, or we're going to see more cows and fewer hands. And that's going to create extreme opportunity for those folks that are left in the industry that are ready to manage and be in that group. There's going to be fewer of us all the time, but we're going to be better operators. This is a slide that kind of encapsulates a little bit of what we talked about. I'm not going to spend a lot of time because we talked about it. The first line, though, I think numbers of operations with less than 99 cows operations declined 20% in this period of time. Now, if you see anything in our cattle industry, in the beef industry, that changes 20% in that period of time, that's significant. We're a fairly unwieldy industry, aren't we? So to see that quick of a shift, that big of a shift, and that quick of a time makes you sit up and pay attention. Again, that's something that we probably see going to continue. The percentage of beef cows in operations declined from 52 to 46, going less. The number of operations with more than 100 cows increased 9%. Again, a very, very, very large increase in an industry like ours that is known for moving very, fairly slowly over time. The percentage of beef cows has grown. They've taken that over. I never thought, I came to Califax in the late 80s, I never thought I'd see the day where that increase would go into these bigger operations. Well, I spent a little bit of time on this last one. 15% of the cows are in herds greater than 500 head as of last year. Now, there's about 800,000 operations out there, according to the last census data. In this group, 500 head and bigger, there's about 5,500 operators. It's a fairly small group. When you see all the people here in Reno, and it's my understanding that the pre-registration registration is large, you take 5,500, there's a lot of new folks in this room and in this convention this week. You start taking that group of decision makers, so you can see it's the same as we keep talking about. That group of decision makers are getting smaller all the time. But they're better operators, they're more savvy, they're more willing to listen to what's going on. They know that we're in a changing time and a changing environment, and they want to be here and they want to figure it out. And that is what we're doing, that's what we're going to be doing over the course of this next week. It's a very, very challenging, very, very changing environment. We're in the West, and we wanted to spend a few minutes. The West has gone through extreme changes here, really, in the last 20 years. The folks in the West have been extremely innovative over time. It's not because they wanted to, it's because it's been forced upon them. The marketplace has changed, it has shifted, it has moved time after time after time, and in order to survive, and those folks that are here and have survived, were more than willing to make these changes and keep looking forward and continue to do that. If you look at just the percent of cattle, here's what we talked about. 4% Northwest, 4% Southwest. We talked about John Wayne country, all the big ranch country. You go down to, and a lot of you folks are here from the Southeast, you go give a talk and you show this graph to them, they're just amazed. They would guess that 50% of all the cows are in the western U.S. Well, heck, the Southeast outpaces them by a long ways. It's a fairly, fairly small, but a real vital part of our industry. We've had so many decision makers come out of the West. It's been amazing over time. If you look at what's happened to the beef cows, as we talked about it here a couple slides ago, you can see in the Southeast that herd size has been pretty flat. We've had a big increase in the North Plains. The South Plains, amazingly, has been pretty flat. But in the West, the Northwest has gone from the average cow herd in 1986 from 33 to currently at 48. That's a big increase, again, in a short period of time. The Southwest the same way. That average cow herd has increased by 15 head per herd. And again, that's a big, big shift over time. So again, there are going to be fewer operators in the West, and they're getting to control more of the cows. The big difference here especially, too, is we see the cattle on feed. The Northwest has always been a pretty good balance. But in the Southwest, we've gone from, as a percent of cattle on feed, of 12% back in the 70s to currently 6%. So what happened? What changed? What moved? What shifted? It's just a fascinating story. A lot of people will tell you that the birthplace of cattle feeding is in the Southwest. It's actually in the Coahuila Valley of California and in southern Arizona. And this has happened in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, when this industry was really starting to go. We certainly have some feed yards in the Midwest, and that was starting to go. But the big, large commercial feed yards, a lot of people will tell you, happened in this country. They had great weather. They had a lot of feed aftermath. They had a lot of things to feed the cattle. We used to haul cattle of calves from the Southeast into the Southwest to feed because they had the idea and they had the facilities. So we'd move all these cattle. It was kind of the birthplace and where we went. Heck, man, I'm still here. I thought I was going, getting ahead of myself. But all these things started to move. Well, what happened? Well, in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, there's companies like IBP, Iowa Beef Producers, came up and they started building big plants in the Midwest. And they started running thousands of head of cattle through there every day. If you look back in the Southwest at that time, especially an area like L.A., L.A. had up to 20 packers in the 70s at one point in time, just that area. But they're all small packers. You know, if they run 1,000 head a day, they're pretty good sized. What would they do coming back? How would they sell the meat? Either in a carcass or in a half a carcass. Somebody would pull that van up to the back door, and they'd throw in a side of beef, and away you went. And everything, you know. That side of beef, then they would get into a butcher shop somewhere or to a store somewhere, and they would cut it. It's in the day, and we all, I think a lot of us long for that day when somebody would come in and they'd cut you off steak or a roast. But then all of a sudden, these packers in the Midwest began doing something even different than that. What is it that they did that revolutionized the whole industry? Put it in a box. Who'd have thunk it? The guys in the Southwest and in L.A. said, I don't know. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have to add. We're getting along just fine. What they found out, though, is that the guys in the Midwest in a big mass production system could do it cheaper. They started calling their customers, and they said, do you want a whole carcass? And they said, well, that's the only way we can get it, the retailers. And they said, well, we can just give you a box of chucks or a box of loins. Well, I can't afford it. They found out they could actually get it shipped out to the West cheaper than what they could produce it for in-house. So all of a sudden, these packers started losing all the customers. Packers continued to fight in the Southwest. So they started shutting down. They started going out of business. Labor costs were rising in those days sharply. You had land values soaring. A lot of them just shuttered and sold out to developers. What happened, though? That left feed yards, and that left a lot of other cow-calf producers without a traditional market. They were forced to shift. They were forced to change. Cattle started going away from the West. Southeast cattle started going to the Midwest instead of the West. They lost that marketplace. Okay, so what do you do? How do you adapt? How do you change? If this is in a time when nobody had thought of these things, the feeders started saying, okay, I've lost my marketplace, I better create a new one. They started forming alliances. Ralph's Beef utilizing cattle holstings are only fed and raised in California, actually killed over in Sunland in Arizona, but bought back Harris Ranch Beef, an alliance situation. Cow-calf or genetics all the way into a retail store. Now, again, at a time when this was unheard of, they started doing this thing. Yards began using even more aftermath, carrot tops. Whatever they could find is extremely, as you know, California, Arizona, a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit grown. They had a lot of things to use from. They used even more. A lot of feed yards went out of business. We lost all that packing capacity. There's really only three main packers left in this country, in the Southwest. And that left, of course, a hole for the cow-calf guys. The other thing that we did is we started feeding Holsteins in the Southwest. You can see the growth in the Holstein business. It worked very good for Southern California and Arizona packer and feeders. You got great weather. You can keep those yards full for a year. These Holsteins will go on at 275 pounds, and they'll be fed for a year. Kept the pens full. You have a growing source. You started forming alliances, you started forming ways to marketplace, and you were back in business. Cow cattle producers had to change too. So what did they do? They had lost their marketplace. Their marketplace had shifted on them. So they said, okay, if the marketplace is in the Midwest or in the Plains, I'm going to go find those folks. They went in there and they started saying, hey, you know, come buy my cattle. I'm going to work with him. I'm going to retain a few. We're going to find out if you like cattle. If you went to a convention here, and you still can, California, Cattlemen's Convention, Northwest Cattle Convention, you always had feed yards sitting there at those conventions with booths. I talked to Jim Miles yesterday, and he reminded me Monson used to come down, Monson Feed Yard. He set that booth and give away Washington apples. You know, they just did a lot of different things. A lot of folks say, okay, we're going to form that relationship with feedlots. We're going to market cattle all the way through. And then we do that for a couple of years. These feedlots will come out and buy cattle from us. And it worked well. Some buy ranches in the Mountain West. They started staging cattle. They grow calves. Summer grazing in the mountains, and they finish them in the plains. A lot of different things. The Californians began to look a different way in the Northwest, folks, too. The rise of the video. Supreme, Western, Ellington, Andy Peak. Looking for a way to market their cattle. That's a way to introduce their cattle to a whole universe out there, and they took advantage of it. Northwest. This region has been historically real balanced. Cow-calf packing capacity, cow-calf feedlot packing capacity, all been in balance. Now, we recently have lost markets up there, especially because of the ban from imports from BSE. We've lost some packers in the Northwest. So more and more of these cattle are being forced east. They're having to add those costs and putting that freight on cattle and take them to feed and be processed in the east. So it's been difficult. Turmoil in the Canadian feeding and packing business continues. A lot of these cattle will continue coming south, but instead of going into the Northwest, a lot of those cattle probably be funneled more into the plains. How do we adapt up there? Feed yards, they can be potato waste. They can be competitive in real high time to high corn. They have another feed source that they can rely on. That's how they have adapted over time. They made use of something that's around. They have closer proximity to the Pacific Rim. They have programs in place that they can start to import and, to export into the Pacific Rim. Whatever it takes, anything from growing Wagyu cattle to coming with ID systems, they're ready to export. They see that marketplace, they want to grasp it. They price cattle up on the fed side off the plains prices, so they aren't relying on more than one packer bidding them. They come to agreement with those packers, that's how we're going to do it. Feeders and packers can utilize Canadian cattle supplies to keep the cost of supply of both feedlots and packing capacity year-round. A lot of people say, hey, this isn't good. Canadian cattle aren't good. But most people tell you in the feedlot and the packing capacity, we'd like to have a few all ready to keep our guys in business. What are those folks doing now? What I see, and I still talk to a lot of yards, a lot of cow-calf producers out there, what do I see them doing? Right now, ID is big out here. They want to ID, they want to know the cattle, they want to know the genetics, they want to know the backgrounds, because they want the export market, they're willing to go out and they're willing to fight for it. It's big. They're still continuing to look and grasp for alliances. What can we do different? What can we do more of? They're always looking for a different market. Natural, whatever it takes, they're willing to look for that. They really embrace technology. Whatever it takes, technology-wise, they're willing to do. Risk management is big. If you're feeding cattle for a year in one pen, you'd better manage your risk. Because in the changing world, you put cattle out a year ago, a lot of things change in that period of time. So they use risk management. Randy, ready to take us home?
I think as we look at a number of these things that Dwayne has just shared with us relative to the West and the transitions we've gone through there, as we look at all these areas of the country, I think we can learn a lot from the West. Obviously, when we think about how much feed costs have increased all across this country, we have to look at alternative feed sources. I know a number of you as cow-calf and stocker operators are using some of these distillers' grains that are out here. We may be using a lower quality roughage source. A number of you have implemented starting feeding more straw and adding some sort of a protein source to that to keep our costs down. Those are some of the things I think we have to do, because in the short term, over the next 2 or 3 years, I think we all have to come to grips with, we are going to be faced with high feed costs, whether it's hay, whether it's grains, whatever the case may be. We think about some of these regional cost differences. We shared with you earlier when Mike went through his presentation, we showed the $6 and $7 a hundred discounts because of the freight difference from the west to the central plains. $11 or $12 a hundred now in the southeast compared to the central plains. Remember, this market dip tends to, over a long period of time, it'll migrate back towards those averages, won't it? It'll migrate back to where we become a zero-sum game. So that means if we're in one of these areas, we have to do something different. We can't continue to do business the way we've been doing it. If we're cow-calf producers, what's the message in here today if we're cow-calf producers? Selling calves off the cow probably is not going to be very favorable to us over the next 2 or 3 years. We've got to figure out a way to add weight. The price spreads between calves and yearlings is going to narrow. We've got to add weight. The market is telling us we want bigger cattle, isn't it? It wants bigger feeder cattle. And taking advantage of our grazing resources, our lower cost feed resources, in order to do that, that's something we've got to do. The days of being able to sell a calf off the cow, doing that kind of thing, I don't think we're going to like the arithmetic on that over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. You've seen this stair steps of profitability or points of differentiation. If you go down through here and you start adding these things up, it's real money. Now, I know a number of you in the room are already taking advantage of these, but some of you aren't. Feedlot carcass data. Knowing how these cattle are going to perform in the feed yard, we're willing to pay for that. We have been for a number of years. Preconditioned weaned healthy calves. Has the market been paying for it? $5 to $8 a hundred the last 3 years. What is the single biggest challenge for a feed yard in the United States today? Labor. Labor. They don't want a bunch of balling calves coming into their yards. They can't manage them. They can't manage them. That's why we'll continue to pay for that in our overall system. Source and age verified cattle. We've had this discussion in this industry for the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Maybe it's been a decade now. Let's get with it. The market is paying us $25 a head on average for source verified cattle. Some of these programs are paying as much as $35 and $40 a head. $35 and $40 a head if they're source verified and they're eligible to go to Japan. 21 months and less. All it takes is a little bit of record keeping. A little bit of record keeping. It's free money. It's free money nearly if we're able to go out here and take advantage of some of those things. And when we have these kind of cost pressures, I think that's something we have to do. How can we add some more things on the positive side of the ledger? We see all these things growing on the negative side of the ledger. Let's balance this thing out. And I think if we take advantage of some of these programs, some of you are looking at natural programs, organic, whatever, differentiating the product is going to continue to be key. Remember, week in and week out, there's a $25 to $30 a hundred variation in what calves will bring in any state in the United States. Every week, there's that kind of price differentiation taking place. You decide. You decide if you want to keep doing business the way you've been doing it, or if you want to take advantage of some of these things, and these are happening today. They're out there today. We've talked about preconditioned calves. How about some of those price spreads? This is price spreads going back here over the last 4 or 5 years. A prime choice spread, $27. A CAB to choice spread, $12. That's not a head, that's a hundred. These are real. genetics make the difference, don't they? Yeah, we can feed cattle, but genetics is really what makes the difference here. Making the right genetic decisions. Some of these are freebies. Some of them are freebies. Genetics don't cost very much in this business today. When you look at the difference in genetics, they really don't cost that much. We need to focus more on what animals are going to get us the kind of offspring calves that we need to be able to capture some of these added values. $50 to $100 a head in today's market in added premiums on some of these programs, it's pretty consistent. It's pretty darn consistent week in and week out. We look at the added value of these premium grades, the higher quality grades in our industry. $500 to $600 million a year. $500 to $600 million a year is where we would put the worth of all those added values over and above our average mix of cattle in our industry. Again, that doesn't fit for everybody. It doesn't fit for everybody. And I'm not suggesting it does. Some of your regions of the country just don't play to this part of the game. But I want us all to understand this commodity market that we all cut our teeth on is changed. There is tremendous value differences out here. There's ways to differentiate this to where we can capture more dollars. I think we have more opportunities today than any time in the history of our industry. Think about if we'd had these costs escalating 10 or 15 years ago and none of these value-added programs out here. Now, that would be a train wreck. That would be a train wreck. But today, because we have so many decisions that we can make to differentiate our offspring calves that we're producing or the feeder cattle or the feeding programs that we're feeding to our fed cattle, it gives us a chance. It gives us a chance to come back in here and really be able to right the ship. So I think when we think about some of those things, yeah, we can all get down and say, yeah, these costs are out of line, they're crazy. It's here. What we need to do is focus on what we can change. Focus on the things that we can impact and change, and these are just some of those things that we can do. Dwayne did a great job of walking us through these structural changes. 78,000 cow-calf operators control 55% of the cows. He said there was 800,000 of them out here. 75,000 of them control 55% of the cows. That's not very many, is it? When we look at the feed yards, 261 feed yards are the top 26 feeding companies are feeding half the cattle today. What do you think that'll look like here in the next 2 years? Is it going to grow? Is that concentration going to grow? Absolutely. We are going to see more concentration at the feeding and packing level over the course of the next couple of years. We've seen tremendous retail consolidation, not just domestically, but globally. Walmart's big in other parts of the world too, aren't they? And Costco's, and we go on and on and on, Ahold, that group, all of those are major players in the world market. So I think as we look at this, we need to anticipate with a vision, fewer players, fewer decision makers as we move down the road. Globalization is here. It is here. We are in a global market. We are going to continue to operate in a global market. What's our niche? What's our niche in that global market? Producing high-quality fed beef, isn't it? We will not compete with the Australians, the New Zealanders, the Argentinians, or the Brazilians in the grass-fed beef business. That's not our niche. But our niche is producing high-quality fed beef for our domestic market and for the world markets as those opportunities continue to grow. We are going to see more concentration. Absolutely no doubt about it. More branding, more differentiation. I would just say to you, figure out where you fit there. Figure out where you fit. We're not going to turn around and go back to just being a commodity business. This branding, product differentiation is going to continue to accelerate. In this high grain world that we're living in today, are the spreads going to widen or are they going to narrow? which way, they're going to widen, aren't they? The spreads are going to widen in this high grain world that we're going to operate in here over the course of the next several years. The management strategies, yeah, we've talked about it. We don't have an inventory cycle anymore. But we still have some production cycles. We've got production differentiation. We still have some price cycle in here. Prices are likely on fed cattle to move higher over the next several years with this high cost of grain. They have to. They have to. Just keep in mind, can they move high enough to offset to carry the calf and feeder market along with it? Think about what happened this last year. I want you all to think about it. Grain prices took off in the fall of 2006. The fed cattle market was 85 bucks a head higher on average in 2007 than it was in 2006. The cost to put on 550 pounds of gain increased about 125 bucks a head on average across the United States. The fed market went up 80 bucks a head. The calf market was 35 bucks a head lower than it was the year prior. Is that a pretty efficient market? Add 85 and add 35, and you're about right there at 120 bucks a head. What would have happened to our calf market had we not been able to advance fed cattle prices the way we did? That 85 bucks a head would have come right off the value of these calves and feeder cattle. So I think when we look longer term, we need to look at this market, we need to look at the environment totally differently than we have in the past. What seems high may not be high in the future. It may not be high. We hope you all have a great convention. We appreciate you being with us this morning. Let's thank Pfizer again for making the day possible. We have time for a few questions. If there's any questions, we'd be glad to take them.
This has been a production of Angus Productions, Incorporated, the industry's information leader.